Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And think about the news of the day that we've been discussing compared to what we are about to discuss. Yes, Bill Thompson is dropping out of the mayoral race. That's some big news, but candidates come and candidates go. A government shutdown deadline in D.C. at the end of the month. Ho-hum, that seems to be every time we wake up. But here's something that doesn't happen every day. The first human-made thing has reached interstellar space. Isn't that incredible? The Voyager 1 left the Earth in 1977 and is now 11.7 billion miles away, traveling at 38,000 miles an hour, and just Thursday left the solar system. OMG. You might remember that the Voyager, in addition to carrying now vintage scientific equipment, is also carrying Carl Sagan's gold records, a sort of time capsule. And we are honored now to have Carl Sagan's widow, Andrienne, here. She is the creative director of the NASA Voyager Interstellar Record Project and executive producer of Cosmos, a space-time odyssey. Anne, thanks so much for coming on WNYC on this historic occasion. Hello.
It's my pleasure, Brian. Great to be with you.
And also joining us is Neil deGrasse Tyson, I promise you, the biggest stars of the stellar-gazing universe, the astrophysicist with the American Museum of Natural History. They are together, Anne and Neil, working on a relaunch of Carl Sagan's show, Cosmos, slated for next year. Neil, thanks for coming on again.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure, Brian. Thanks
for having me. So, Neil, blow our minds here. Tell us just how amazing it is that something we made has reached interstellar space.
Yeah, well, first, you know, these days it's hard to achieve these kinds of firsts because this is a first that was set into motion back in 1977. And back then, hold aside the record that's on it, which captures our culture and our the spirit of what it is to be human. That starts out as simply a science project, right? You build this craft, and then you find out, wait a minute, it's not just going to go to one planet, it's going to go to many planets, because the configuration of the solar system at the time, this is a fact that people forget about today, but it was a big deal back then. The configuration of the planets was such that you could send it on a particular trajectory and give it like a three-cushion pool shot and have it go around Jupiter and Saturn and Uranus. And so it was a fortuitous configuration of the planets that allowed Voyager not to have a single destination but many, and then go beyond the solar system because we gave it enough energy to escape the gravitational pull of the sun. And it is that fact that turns Voyager into a different species of space probe. Because once you know the thing is going to leave and never come back to the solar system, it can take on a whole other role as an explorer. And then comes in the value of all that the project that Anne had led to affix the iconography of who and what we are as humans on Earth to this craft in case it's then discovered one day by another intelligent species.
And we'll get to what we're actually learning from Voyager 1 as it departs our solar system. But Anne, remind us what the golden records are, and we'll hear an excerpt or two coming up, and what's on them.
Well, it's a kind of Noah's Ark of human culture as it was on a beautiful spring in 1977. So it consists of greetings in 59 human languages and one whale language, a sound essay, which takes us from the early geological periods of the Earth through the biological into the technological, as well as 27 pieces of exquisite music, often considered the birth of world music, and 118 pictures of life on Earth, including people from all over the world and images of Bach's music and many different aspects of human experience.
And since you were in charge of the musical contributions to the discs, Here's a sampling of the human music that we sent out to the world beyond our solar system eventually in 1977. Play DJ here and back announce the set. That was Beethoven's Fifth, Azerbaijanian Bagpipes, El Cascabel, performed by Lorenzo Barsaletta and the Mariachi Mexico, Bach's Brandenburg Concerto No. 2 in F, and Johnny Be Good, written and performed by Chuck Berry. So is the idea here, Anne, really that maybe some creatures from who knows where out there, millions or billions of miles away, might actually hear this music and understand something about us someday?
Yes, well, it's probably, you know, the record is redolent with all kinds of information on many different levels. I mean, the spacecraft itself will tell any other spacefaring civilization so much about our rate of technological development at that moment. But the great thing about Voyager is that it's a kind of intersection of our state-of-the-art technology, but also there are the brainwaves of a woman newly fallen in love, a mother's first words to her newborn baby. It's so soulful. And this great variety of music from all the continents is, you know, even if it's never intercepted, because after all, space is very empty and very vast, and there are only two spacecraft, even if no one intercepts it, it's a kind of a cultural arc of who we were. You know, it has a projected shelf life of 1,000 million years. And that was done by the guys who thought the ship would only last and send us information for maybe 5 years. Now we're 36 years on. 1,000 million years from now, the continents will be so different. So if you were a spacefaring human who was returning home, you wouldn't even recognize the place. And yet, our music will survive.
So listen,
and something of our feelings, too.
I would add here that the contents of this representative contents of our species is the best of who we are. And every time I hear that, I'm reminded of what we can be and what we still can be. But then I turn, you know, and then I turn left or right, and then I see so much of what we do as humans that is not that. And I'd like to think, as Anne said, space is vast and empty, and maybe it'll never be found. But the fact that Anne and her team even thought to do this is such a powerful statement of hope that I find myself turning to its contents just when I'm about to give up hope, watching Congress not agreeing on something that should happen or war breaking out. I'm saying, is there any hope left? Yes, there is hope. And we tried to do that in 1977.
Go ahead.
No reason why I can't try to still do it as we go forward.
And we are talking about the milestone, the really epic milestone of the first thing made by human beings leaving our solar system, Voyager 1, which passed that threshold last Thursday, talking about it with Anne Drian, who is intimately involved in the gold disk of information that we just sampled from, co-founder of Cosmos Studios, widow of Carl Sagan, and astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson from the American Museum of Natural History, and of course the planetarium there. And folks, if you ever wanted to ask a question about life beyond our solar system, or existence beyond our solar system, whether we call it life or not, but never had anyone to ask, now you do. 212-433-WNYC for the next few minutes. 212-433-9692. So, Neil, what will NASA scientists be looking to learn now that Voyager has left the solar system?
Well, you know, you know, there's not much left that works on the craft. In fact, the very instrument that would have measured us exiting the solar system trivially, it's sort of a plasma a detection device, that has long since ended its operation. And so this crossing out of sort of the solar wind influence of our neighborhood into interstellar space required sort of secondary and tertiary measurements to come to this conclusion. And the head scientist is at University of Iowa. The craft is built and designed at the Jet Propulsion Labs. And so there is a whole legacy of science and engineering that went in to try to make this happen. And so once you're beyond it, you're in interstellar space. I don't know what more Voyager will tell us, unless there's something we don't expect. And so much of the great scientific discoveries occur because you say, okay, we're smooth sailing now, and then something happens that no one predicted. But right now in interstellar space, we would expect the equipment to continue to register the same kind of signal as they did upon entering interstellar space. There's no known unknown out there.
Phyllis in Ocean Township, you're on WNYC. Hi, Phyllis.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Quick question. How long does it take for us to get the information that we're receiving from whatever it is, the capsule, till it reaches here? I mean, has the capsule changed by the time we've gotten the information?
Neil?
Oh, yeah. I forgot the... I forgot how many... Do you remember, Ann?
Oh, of course I do, because I get reports every week and every few weeks. It's 18 hours.
So the craft talks directly to you.
18, not directly to me, not by any means, but I do, you know, stay tuned because two answers. One is it's 18 light hours away. So a single exchange with Voyager takes about 36 light hours. So that's, you know, so the idea that we've sent something that we made with 8-track technology in the early 1970s is still communicating with us across essentially 18 light hours.
It's got 70K of memory, by the way, which was a big deal back then. That, of course, the communication time is continuing to grow as it moves away from us.
Yes. And your cell phone has 250,000 times more memory than the Voyager.
I don't believe that. Say that again.
I say that the phone that you probably have nearby, your cell phone has 250,000 times more memory than the Voyagers do.
Wow. Jerry in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello.
What's your question?
Oh, my question is to Dr. Carl Sagan. We have a very sophisticated listing.
Mrs. Sagan or Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson, but go ahead.
My question is to Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson.
We have a very powerful
listening post known as Arecibo in Puerto Rico, and I was wondering if we can still hear signals from the Voyager, even though it is in interstellar space.
Neil, are you familiar with Arecibo?
Yeah, of course, and it's the largest radio telescope in the world, the single-dish telescope, and it's a very powerful device, and it's actually made a cameo appearance in several films, including the beginning of the film Contact. So what's happening is there's Voyager still communicating with us, and as it gets farther and farther away, the signal gets diluted, all right, and it's diluted because of the space across which it has to traverse. We have what's called a deep space network, which is a network of radio telescopes around the Earth that are tasked with communicating with these distant NASA space probes. And so right now they're detecting 1/10 billion-billionth of a watt of energy that happens to reach us compared to what is emitted from that craft. There'll be a point where we can no longer detect it above our thresholds, and no matter the telescope, and then it's off forever, never to be seen again, unless we catch up with it one day.
And before we go, Anne, tell us about the relaunch of Cosmos, the first big science-themed TV show that your late husband Carl Sagan did host and which you originally co-created. I gather Neil will be the new host, so what will it be like, Anne?
Well, it will be, we are really launching off of the original series, taking a couple of the elements that have a kind of unrivaled explanatory power to teach and to convey some of these ideas, but it's 13 completely new hours of cosmos, new stories. I'm not new in the sense that they just happened, but new in that they have largely never been told before. New drama and a great new adventure in space and time. So I'm thrilled that it's going to be on Fox and Sunday nights in the spring, late winter, early spring.
And you're producing it with Seth MacFarlane. Now, what's his interest in science and space? I thought he was into, like, bro humor and show tunes.
Well, you know, Seth has a very broad spectrum of interests. And, in fact, if it wasn't for Seth's interest in science, this new series probably never would have been produced, certainly not on the scale and with the production values and the platform that we have now. So it was Seth's tremendous affection for Cosmos that made it possible for us to really do what we're doing now. And that came about because he met Neil, and Neil and I were already working on the new series.
Andrea.
I would add that if fans of Family Guy, which is sort of his flagship product, right. If every third episode, there's some reference to science in some way, be it the Stewie making a time machine and thinking about the space-time continuum. There's even a hilarious reference to Cosmos in an
Cosmos
edited
for
version.
Rednecks.
Cosmos edited for rednecks. So there is a science literacy, a science sensitivity that threads throughout Seth MacFarlane's work, and it is that piece of him that has risen up and has come to help us enable this project.
So we're going to go out on another song on the golden records that have now left the solar system on Voyager 1, a little bit of Melancholy Blues performed by Louis Armstrong and his Hot 7. My guests have been Andrew Yan and Neil deGrasse Tyson. So exciting. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
What a pleasure.
And coming up next, we'll hear how the internet is making us smarter and stupider at the same time. We'll hear Bill Thompson drop out of the mayoral race, and we'll hear John Schaefer with his mayoral election remix project. Stay with us, Brian Lehrer on WNYC.